science can't explain everything. Just because you can't see me doesn't mean I'm not here.
Thank you for joining me, everyone, and welcome to Paranormal Encounters podcast series. My name is Dr. Kelly Renee Schutz. I am the host and the producer of this show. Sit back, grab yourself some popcorn, and let's get started.
Be careful what you wish for.
Good evening, everyone. Yes, indeed. Let's get started. We have a two-part show with treasure hunters Terry Carter and Kent Smith. So sit back and enjoy, because I think you're going to find them to be very, very interesting. Stay tuned.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.
Feel like doing a little treasure hunting today? Well, if we were to ask Terry Carter and Kent Smith, I would bet the answer would be yes. A very brief intro on each of them as my guests this evening. Terry Carter is an explorer, researcher, and up-and-coming YouTuber. He has been treasure hunting since 1981. He has also been seen on the History Channel show Beyond Oak Island, the Lost Josephine Mine, where he has actively been searching for a billion-dollar treasure in gold bars. Terry has also traveled across the western United States in search of out-of-place artifacts, ancient treasures, mysterious giants, and the unspoken history of the United States. He is the original founder of Ancient Historical Research Foundation, which was the first that consisted of a hand of scientists, archaeologists, researchers, and explorers searching for truth through science and technology. In just a moment, we will meet Terry Carter, who will tell us a little bit more about his exciting journey in doing just that. Now let's turn our attention to Kent Smith. Kent Smith is a historian, collector, and lecturer. He has collected and written over 17 diaries of personal stories on such things as treasure, mines, and burials. He is one of two originators of the Morgan Powwow, now known as the Gathering at Moon Lake. He has continued for 24 years, highlighting treasure, outlaws, Bigfoot, skinwalkers, UFOs, and other interesting subjects. Ken started being interested in ancient American history in Utah in about 1956 when he and a friend were just out horsing around and found some treasure, which consisted of several coins, gold, a ruby, and several buckles and bones. Kent's knowledge, libraries, collections, and also his abilities has provided him with many opportunities, especially when treasure hunting. Kent has been given photographs, original maps, and maps that have drawn him to mines, burials, treasures, giant mummies, skeletons, and numerous other things. Let us now sit back and meet my guests for the evening, Terry Carter and Kent Smith. Well, hello, gentlemen, and thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for inviting us.
So today, everybody, we have Terry Carter and Kent Smith, best known as treasure hunters, that are going to be talking with us on the show. And this is one subject that I have not ever really thought too much about until I went to a conference and I saw them speaking. And I said to myself, maybe this is something that everybody should at least learn a little bit about. And so we're going to have a real good session this hour. And I think we'll start with you, Terry. And I'm going to ask the question that I ask everybody, but think about how you want to answer here. Where did all of this, we don't even have to go with the aspect of treasure hunting, but I want you to go back to your earlier age, as young as you can remember, and tell us a little bit about what inspired you or interested you in, and we're going to add in the paranormal or anything extraterrestrial or just basically treasure hunting. What was the first thing that came for you?
Geez, I can remember when I was a little kid, like 5 or 6 years old, seeing a TV show about, and it was a real live show, about finding the treasure that was washing up off the coast of Florida, you know, off them Spanish galleons had sunk. And in my mind, I thought, man, I'm gonna become a scuba diver. I'm gonna go find that Spanish galleon, that treasure hunting, you know, but I was just a little kid. And then after a while, you know, you forget about that stuff. But back in 1982, I went to work out in Vernal, Utah on a power plant out there. And I started hearing stories about all these fantastic treasures, whether it was in the Uinta Mountains there in Utah, that had to do with Spanish treasure. It wasn't in the ocean, but it was in the mountains. And I thought, man, that's right up my alley. And not only that, I spent a lot of time in the Uinta Mountains hunting and stuff. And so when I started seeing some of the things they was talking about in the books, and there'd been places I'd seen some of this stuff, I just didn't know that it had to deal with Spanish treasure. You know, and so that's how I got started, was when I learned about that. But then it evolved from when I started finding some things that didn't fit with Spanish, but it was still a treasure, but it had to deal with the ancients. And so it evolved from just strictly treasure hunting to searching for out-of-place archaeology, things that just didn't fit, wasn't normal. So,
interesting. And again, remind me, because I wasn't real good in the topic of history especially, but did the Spaniards settle in that area quite a while ago, or do you think something else did, and it just so happens that this is the stuff that you were finding first in what you're doing?
Man, that's a tough question. Yeah. Because archaeologists, the mainstream academia, says that, you know, Columbus was here first, there was nobody else here before that, you know. But I'm finding out, you know, that Columbus wasn't the first here. He was the last. There was the Romans, the Greeks, the Egyptians, the Phoenicians, the Vikings. They was all here way before Columbus. And I don't know, you know. It's just as far as the Uinta Mountains here in Utah, you know, the Spaniards, they was trying to track down where Montezuma took his treasure. Cortez got into Mexico, seen all the treasure they had, and then they drove them out, the Spaniards out, and they took all their treasure and took it back to their native ancient homeland, which was Aztlán, which was the base of the Great Salty Lake, which people think's a lot of different places, but I think it's right here in Utah, and I think the source of the gold came from the Uinta Mountains. Well, the Spaniards, trying to track down where Montezuma took his treasure, came up in here to the Uintas, seen the Indians had gold, and they started enslaving the Indians, making them tell where it was at, started enslaving them, working them right to death, making them, you know, and the Indians didn't like that program, working to death. So they revolted against the Spaniards, killed them, drove them off, took whatever it took to hide all the mines up, hide all the treasure up, whatever it took, they did that. And that's how we got the story of the Lost Roads mine, which is more than just one mine. It's hundreds of mines, and in it, and it evolves clear to Aztec treasure, to Roman, to Egyptian treasure. It's just an incredible, fascinating story, and then just trying to put all the pieces together, what really did happen here.
Interesting. Well, we're going to ask a little bit of questions here as we go along on this. Kent, your turn.
Yes. Yeah.
So when you were a young tyke, what age were you approximately when you first became real interested in doing this type of work?
Well, Terry and I are pretty similar on a lot of this. I was about 4 and 5 years old when I got interested in archaeology. Mm. So it wasn't treasure, it was archaeology, and living in Utah. And Utah is one of the best, hottest places in the world for archaeology, ancient Indian things, and that petroglyphs in particular is one of the things you could find easy in that. And so as a very small child, I started looking at that stuff. In 1960, when I was about 8, 9 years old, a friend and I, after school, just playing typical kids games. Maybe it's not typical anymore. Typical games, probably going home playing games on your computer. But we were playing tag, tag ear it and chase him, and tag ear it and running back and forth. And my friend jumped down in a dry ditch and found a coin. And so we stopped our playing tag and started digging in the ditch bank, and we found a treasure. There was coins, there was a gold medal with a ruby in it, there was bones, there was buckles, there was all kinds of things involved in that. I was only in third grade at the time. Mm. Obviously, that's pretty exciting when you're young like that. And I hadn't really given it a lot of thought other than I liked archaeology, but it was always chasing Indian type stuff up to that point. Then I figured out that, hey, there's more to it than just the Indian stuff. And by the way, this wasn't a Spanish treasure, but it was hundreds of years old. But it was interesting. The gold medal that I found, pretty good sized gold medal with a ruby in it, depicted the birth of Christ. Mm-hmm. On the front of it, and on the back it had an inscription, which we eventually got translated, and it was first place in a speech contest, which I thought was kind of cool for being hundreds of years old. But anyway, so from that point, then it started branching out into other things. And as Terry says, you go to your history books and that, and that's all scripted. Nothing can change out of the way they've written the history books. If you're an archaeologist or something, you try to come up with something new, you'll literally lose your job. You won't be able to teach. You won't be able to do all the different things. But there's so much stuff in the United States and that. And I study all over archaeology from all over the world. I have a huge library, probably bigger than most of the universities and that. But I personally know about, just real close to my home here, within a 10-mile radius of my home, four sets of Egyptian panel writing and other extinct writing and that. But there's things all over the place. Aside from doing all my own personal running around, I take people on tours. I take people to private museums that you see things that you'll never see. But my interest in all of this started at the age of about 5, and I've just had it my whole life, and I've reached a point. I'm retired now, but before I was retired, I had sometimes 6 and 8 people a week maybe come into my office and give me maps and tell me stories, family stories and things and that. And now I have literally hundreds or thousands of stories on treasure and sacred burial grounds and lost mines and all those kinds of things. And it's just a total fascinating subject to me.
Interesting. So I have a question for both of you, but Terry, you could probably start out on this. So am I safe to assume that both of you grew up in Utah in a place or even close by? I don't even know if you knew each other when you were younger, but in a place where all of this stuff, which, yes, I would probably agree with you, just a magnitude of various things there that one could possibly find. But did you not ever, now it sounds like to me, Kent, you've done some traveling outside of Utah. Terry, have you done any hunting outside of Utah as well?
I early on stumbled onto what I call the mystery glyphs. It's a unique set of hieroglyphs that are neatly and painstakingly carved into cliff walls in remote locations. And I stumbled upon some of them in where I live. And trying to research and figure out where they was. It took me all across the western United States and down into the Yucatan Peninsula trying to figure out what these were. And so, yeah, I've gone all over. And there's been a lot of ancient artifacts near some of these mystery glyphs. And also, the treasure hunting stories. You know, you've got the Lost Dutchman. You've got, the here in Utah, the Lost Roads Mine. You've got treasure stories all over the place. You know, the Spanish galleons off the coast of Florida. I've been to all these places. You know, just talking with the people and looking around a little bit. But I always come back here to home because it's close. You know, and it's an interesting place. There's a lot of things went on here in Utah.
Yeah, you know, the other question I have, maybe one of you can jump in and answer this because I'm always curious. There always seems to be a great mystery around the petroglyphs and who scratched them into the rock and all that. So my husband and I, we went to Dinosaur National Park, absolutely beautiful park, by the way, and he went up into an area. And I may post a couple of these pictures for our viewers to see. Listeners, you might want to watch the show to see some of these pictures. But how is someone able to determine what period they come from? But my biggest question when we were looking at them and found is, how on earth have they maintained or stayed in that rock for all of these years? One of you want to take that question? Any idea? Because that's the biggest mystery to me.
You talking fossils then?
Kinda no, like, I'm talking about petroglyphs.
Kind of like... No, petroglyphs. Yeah.
Well, petroglyphs won't stay forever. They wear off. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting because, like everything else, you do have some people that go out there and carve petroglyphs themselves in trees and on the rocks and those kind of things in our current day in that. But a lot of that is pretty easy to debunk and say, well, this isn't ancient. And one of the reasons on petroglyphs is because the ancients would look for a good substrate to carve their petroglyphs on. In other words, you just don't go out and find any old rock and carve some stuff on it typically. You go out and look for flat surfaces that are black with what's called a patina. So you have chemicals that come to the surface of the rock and make it dark brown or black. And then when you carve it, the part you carve becomes white.
Right.
And so it's like you're writing on a chalkboard or something. Mm-hmm. And they will eventually wear off in that. But some of the ways that you can tell it's old is if it's black rock and you're looking at petroglyphs, is it white? Is it starting to turn tan? Is it starting to turn dark brown? Is it turned back to black? So you've got black writing on black rock. It takes a long time for the patina to come back once you carve it in. And so if it's been there for a very long time, it's going to be dark brown or back to black again. Mm-hmm. If they carved it day before yesterday, it's going to be white, like you're writing on a chalkboard with a piece of chalk. One of the other things that you can date, not only the writing, but rock cairns and things like that, have to do with lichens, which is a plant life that grows on the surface of the rock. And there's actually science behind it. There's books written on it. The different species of lichens that grow, you can read books and study how long it takes for that to grow. And so if you have plant life growing on the rocks, growing over the top of the writing, you can go in and study and see that it takes hundreds of years oftentimes for that much plant life to grow on the rock, which tells you that the carving was done at least however many hundreds of years it took for that lichen growth to be on there. So those are some of the typical things on petroglyphs. There are a lot of other things, but that's a couple of pretty easy ones to look at.
Terry, go ahead.
I think, you know, they don't know really how old those petroglyphs are. You know, it's just a guess on their part. Maybe they found some artifacts that they could carbon date or something to try and get an age on them. But I don't know if you made it to McConkie Ranch and seen the petroglyphs there.
I wanted to get there, but from what I understood, and I took myself off the tour when we were at this conference, it sounded like a little bit more rugged than what I could have wanted to accomplish. And, you know, everything from what, crawling over a under a rock or hanging onto a tree branch or whatever. Now, you would have to help me out on that, because I took myself off the tour because I didn't want to break my ankle or anything. What have both of you, Terry, have you been up there?
Oh, many times, you know. Okay. They're the most spectacular petroglyphs, in my most humble but accurate opinion, in the whole United States. You know, these things are spectacular, and people need to go there. But the great thing about this is it's on private property. The McConkie family owns that, and they've made trails, you know. Some of it's a little bit rugged, but they've made trails, and they've, man, these guys are great. They've made it free to the whole public. You can just go up there and do it. You know, just don't deface them. They ask for donations, but that's up to you to give a donation. People ought to give donations because, you know, for them to graciously let us, you know, look at the most spectacular petroglyphs in the United States. But I was going to say there's a plaque there, you know, that it says, you know, these are probably the Fremont people, and they may be, you know, 1200 AD to 1 AD or something. I don't remember the exact dates. But when they say probably in May, it means they don't know. It's their guessing. Somebody's, you know, it's somebody's theory, and that may or may not be right. It's just a guess. So they really don't know how old they are. But you can tell, you know, sometimes when you have a more modern culture inscribed there, petroglyphs on top of the older stuff, you can see that, which is, you know, the different civilizations or cultures, you know. But it also depends on what type of rock that they inscribed it on. If it's soft sandstone, it's not going to last very long. You know, if it's a harder rock, it can last a long time. You know, talking with some people in New Mexico, some of them shoe marks from the burros and the wagons, you know, making the click marks into the rock, man, they said them things look just as fresh as when the day they was made hundreds and hundreds of years ago. So it just depends on, you know, what type of weathering it gets in the area, how hard the rock is and things like that. But to know how old it really is, there's really no really good way to tell.
Well, I have a question. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Kent.
I might mention that the McConkie Ranch has been highlighted by National Geographic at least three times. They're probably some of the premier petroglyphs in the world at McConkie Ranch. We knew the family personally. They used to come and have accounts and buy groceries from our store that my parents had and different things. But one other thing I failed to mention is a lot of the petroglyphs are done by shaman and those kinds of things, and they have magical powers to the Indians. And so a lot of the Indian tribes didn't get along with each other. In fact, they would go to war, they'd fight all the time. And so if you carved a panel that was magical, they could steal your magic by carving a panel over the top of it. So sometimes you'll have two or three different panels that may span hundreds or even thousands of years carved right over the top of other panels, two or three panels deep. And that was one of the things you could do, is you could carve over another tribe's panel and you could steal their magic from that magic panel. So
interesting. You know, it's fascinating to me. And I maybe, okay, well, first of all, I'm just going to ask a general question, and then I'm going to jump into what's fascinating. So if anyone wants to go out to McConkie Ranch, which is just outside of, how far from Vernal do you think that ranch is?
What do you think, 15 miles, 10 miles?
Probably closer to 10 miles. It's not very far outside of Vernal, off to the northwest of Vernal. You can probably ask about anybody in town, and they can tell you how to get there. It's not hard to find.
And it's a spectacular canyon to go up to, too, with the sheer sandstone cliff walls and things like that. Yeah.
So what would you recommend? Because the reason why I did not, I pulled off of the tour wasn't necessarily, there's probably some stones and stuff that are in a path that go up there, but how rugged is it for the a person of either age or someone who might have knee issues or something like that? What would you recommend? Obviously, wear some kind of hiking boot and or a good tennis shoe, obviously. What would you suggest for people that might want to go and see some of these petroglyphs?
Yeah,
I see it. If go ahead, Kent. Carrying, go ahead, Terry.
No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, if you have need of a cane to walk and that kind of thing, you might be able to see, because it spreads out for a long ways. It's not just one little spot that you walk a long ways along the cliffs, and the petroglyphs probably span thousands of years being carved in different tribes and so forth. But if you need a cane to walk, you're probably not going to get to see very many. You might make it to a couple if you struggle at it. But if you want to see all of it, you're probably just out of luck. If you're at the point of having to have a cane or something worse than that, because it's that rugged. It's not super rugged, but it's bad enough. If you have a cane, you're probably not going to get to see much of it.
Yeah.
They've made a good hiking trail and put up some kind of a rope ladder or stick ladder or stick, rails in places where they thought you might need it, made some steps and whatnot. You know, they've tried to do the best, you know, that they can. But if you've got super bad knees or you're, like Kent says, walking with a cane, you know, you're probably not going to make it. But you definitely do want some hiking shoes so you're not slipping, because there's some little bit of terrain there. And like Kent says, it's spread out over a long period of time. But the most unique petroglyphs is what they call the Three Kings panel. You can get there. It's quite a ways. It's a half mile hike, Kent, would you say? But it's flat ground. You just go through their pasture, you know, got to climb up over one of their ladders that they made going over their fences and whatnot. And it's high up in the cliffs there, and take a pair of binoculars with you. But, man, they are spectacular. These guys they're intricately carved in detail. You know, they've got breastplates and crowns and jewelries. And not only they just pecked in, but they've been painted. So if you take and imagine what that looked like during the day when it was freshly painted, how that would have looked, man, just spectacular.
Yeah, that's the one that I thought I might have had a fighting chance over. I think they might have on that trail, possibly, and I'm not 100% on this, it might be like a wooden plank kind of trail or something that goes out into this kind of this prairie thing, and you can see them from a distance. But I find that to be absolutely unbelievably spectacular. And what we're talking about here is something ginormous, you know, a petroglyph that's an image of something, a picture of something that they depicted back in the day or whatever. How do you think that a physical human being actually carved, when it's ginormous like that and it's so precise in a way where you can actually, you know, so well done, do you think that a human actually carved that, or do you think either one of you, or do you think something else might have lent a hand to it? Because these are on the side of a cliff. You know, think about what you have to do to be on a side of a cliff and to be so precise in your drawing. What are your thoughts, both of you, on that?
Well, my thought is, yeah, they was done by a person who was talented, you know, an artist. They would have, yeah, it was that them are up on a high cliff, but there's a ledge there where they could get up and done it. They'd have had to have some, you know, these petroglyphs are life size, you know, they're not just small figures. These things are life size,
right?
You know, so I'm not really, you know, I'm a treasure hunter. I enjoy out of place archaeology stuff, the stuff that, you know, that academia says shouldn't be here, but it's here, you know, like the Egyptian artifacts is being found, you know, and these things, you know, are kind of an out of place archaeology. These things aren't your regular Native Americans. These things look like they're, well, they could maybe be Aztec, but they look like they're Egyptian. Or, you know, Professor Barry Fell from Harvard University, who started the Epigraphic Society. He's passed away now, but he said, man, these things are Iberian. What are they doing here?
Interesting. Yeah. Iberian. I never even thought about that one. That's really interesting. I want to ask you both a little bit about to educate our listeners and our watchers here just a little bit about the land around. Now, I want to give a kind of a description here. Vernal, Utah is in the upper, what is it, right-hand corner, pretty close to the upper right-hand corner of Utah, probably about 80 miles or so, or give or take, from the Wyoming border up there. And I'm talking a pretty big radius now. I'm not just talking Vernal, Utah. Give us an idea, because I've learned a lot since I was out there regarding that land. So which one wants to take that question about what makes that land a little extra mysterious than perhaps other land in the United States? Wow. Dead silence. Okay. I love it.
The land around Vernal, and by the way, you're about 30 miles to the east is the Colorado border.
Yep.
From Vernal, it's not very far. But the Three Kings Panel is the most famous and popular panel right there in the Vernal area, and it's one of the most famous panels in the world. I know where there's other panels that are quite similar to the Three Kings Panel, again on private property at burial grounds, which I've taken a few people over on tours and things looking at it, but for the most part, the people that own that property, those properties are not going to let you go down there. But like Terry said, they're way different than other petroglyphs. Utah has petroglyphs everywhere, but not like they are in the Vernal area. Those petroglyphs, not all of them, but a lot of the petroglyphs in the Vernal area with the breastplates and the jewelry, and we're talking a lot of jewelry, both earrings and fancy necklaces and everything carved in, and then being carved and then painted on top of the paintings and that, you can't find that anywhere else in the world. And they don't have good answers. Terry said that some people carved it, which I believe as a young man, back when I was a young man, they used to say, well, petroglyphs don't mean anything. They're just somebody expressing their art that's within themselves and that. And even as a young child in first and second grade and that, I thought these so-called scientists that are stupid, because Indians, if you start studying it, they spend a good part of their waking hours in the daytime, most of the tribes and that, trying to find something to eat so they weren't dead of starvation tomorrow. Yeah. And you don't have a lot of time to go out, and it takes a lot of time to make good petroglyphs, and sometimes they would even have to build scaffolding or those kind of things. And even as a young child, I thought it's stupid for somebody to think somebody's just got some artistic ability and they're going out here carving this stuff. It had way more meaning than that, because you wouldn't have done that. You would have been out trying to shoot a deer or a buffalo, or you would have been collecting grasshoppers to roast, to grind up so that you could survive the winter and all those kind of things. And so I study giants and that too, and there's always a possibility of giants. And then you get it, people that are into UFOs more than I am. I could tell you a lot about UFOs, but there's lots of other possibilities. But my own personal feeling is it was carved by regular people, but not just anybody in the tribe. Typically, you're talking shaman. A lot of the petroglyphs probably were done on special. Let's see, how do we want to put this? Psychedelic drugs, that kind of thing, and they would go off and they would make these carvings and that had magical powers and those kinds of things. But by somebody in the tribe that specialized in doing these magical carvings is what they're done by.
Okay, so now I have a question regarding this soil around Vernal and or a large radius in that area, because when I was there were some real interesting things that I experienced that were not typical. And so you guys have lived there, or at least in the area, or a radius from the Vernal area for quite a long time. You've done treasure hunting in that area. Why don't we start here? And I'm kind of lead this into another aspect later on here, but I want to start with, so Kent, you talked a little bit about some of the coins and some of the buckles and stuff that you found as a young tyke. So my question to both of you is this: what was the most interesting find that you discovered in the soil or wherever, around, not just around that area, but probably around a good chunk of that radius where there's a lot of good, what you would say might be a lot of interesting treasure hunting? Who wants to start? The most interesting find.
Eric, go ahead.
Go ahead. You know, treasure hunters are tight-lipped, and they don't want to really tell what they find. You know, and unless you know somebody, you're never gonna hear about it because of the government rules and regulations and whatnot. Right. And so, the most interesting find that I've found, I'm gonna tell you right like I showed in my presentation, Kelly. It's my wife right there from Vernal. That's my best treasure, you know. But as far as that, you know, when you find, you know, and treasure, you can define that a lot of different ways. You know, treasure could be you found a unique petroglyph like the Mestre glyphs, you know, that look like they're kind of Egyptian or carvings, you know. Somebody else has never, that you know of, has seen them before. They're not recorded into history anywhere, and you find that. That's a treasure, you know. There's been all kinds of interesting things found. You know, there's been some Roman coins found up in the Uintas. There's been gold bars and silver bars found up in the Uintas. There's been Spanish armor, breastplates, and swords found up in the Uintas. You know, there's some gems every now and again. There's gold statues that's been found, boulders that's been carved into the shapes of like bear, life-size carvings of bears by who would have carved something like that. That's things that's been found by different people, but you're not going to hear about that or where they're at because treasure hunters are tight-lipped, and you're not going to hear a lot of that, So I'm just going to leave it at that.
Yeah, Terry, I'm glad you brought that up because most people know that I have a legal background and retired from that, but smart enough to know when there's situations that could potentially maybe even get a person in trouble. And I'm not talking you specifically. I'm talking enthusiasts that may get a little bit carried away because they don't understand some of the rules or some of the areas. And if anyone has been to Utah, and like I said, I was there for a short period of time, especially with the mountains and you've got such a vast, wide open sky space and so much to explore and stuff like that, especially. You can't help but wonder now, just as an example, I know that on occasion here that the ground, when it gets cold and iced over and frozen, will at times bring up stuff that has been buried underneath the soil for a long period of time. Kent, let's use you as a good example here. You're just a young tyke with a friend, mittermandering around in a ditch, and all of a sudden, here's this coin that's sitting there. Now, we don't know how long it was sitting there for. We don't know how it got there. We don't know if it came up from the ground, if it gets as cold as it gets in places that I'm aware of where things just start to come to the surface. But they do, or things get eroded away and, you know, a lot of rain and all that stuff. And then eventually it brings up the stuff that's been buried there for a long period of time. Now, as a treasure hunter, that's exciting. And I agree with you, Terry, 100%. A treasure is defined by the person who finds it and finds it to be incredibly unique or special. And of course, your wife is special, you know, but he's not wrong. As soon as you start finding things, you know, then you have to ask bigger questions. Am I allowed to have it? Can I have it? I found it. Am I on somebody else's land? Do they technically own this item that they've never found? There's all kinds of questions that go along with that. Kent, let me jump down to you for a second, because we've had small discussions about this, but Kent, you've been in places too, and where you were allowed to be in places, but could you kind of inform our listeners and our watchers a little bit about some of the things that people can't really do in certain areas in Utah? I'm going to put it on your shoulders for a second.
Okay. I guess I'll fall back to, you've got antiquities laws. It's interesting because I also collect fossils and take groups out fossil collecting, those kind of things. And fossil laws, federal laws, are very similar to the antiquity laws. Several years ago, when I was younger, antiquity laws said that you couldn't pick anything up that was more than 100 years old. The governments got more greedy than what they were then, if that was even possible, and now it's 50 years. So if you pick something up off the ground that's 50 years old or older, you may be in violation of federal law and have potential for a big fine and time in federal penitentiary. And the federal government goes along with what their feelings are at that particular time. I'll give you an example. Yeah. Good friends of mine, actually my best friend's sister and her husband, went boating up at a particular reservoir several times during the summer. Mm-hmm. During that one summer, they found a human foot that was mummified. They found a baby that was a baby Indian that was on a backboard wrapped in rabbit fur, mummified, and they found an Indian chief all the same summer at three different times. The chief was not buried. He was tucked under a ledge. Okay. They figure it was a chief because of what the ceremonial gowns that he was wearing and so forth and that. But they ended up going to the government with the information to see if they wanted to do reparation laws. And the Indians typically would come in and take human remains and take them out and do a secret burial on them or something. So they went to the government, said, "We found these three things. We'll tell you where they're at so the Indians can come and get them or whatever." Instead of them saying thank you, they arrested them, $300,000 fine. And because they had never been convicted of any kind of legal thing before, they put bracelets on their ankles. They reduced their 3 years in federal penitentiary down to 1 year with bracelets on so that they could not go more than however many hundred feet from their phone in their house. And they had given them a $300,000 fine. They reduced that to a $100,000 fine for bringing in the information they just happened to stumble on and saying, "Here's the stuff, come out and get them." They were punished like that. Because of that, how many people are ever going to bring that? Now, this becomes a very sad thing because people learn real quick. You don't tell the government anything because of stupid stuff like that where they try to tell. Some other examples would be, I should have got some to show you here, but a Cobb coin, for example, which may have been produced by the Spanish in the Uintas around Vernal and those kind of things. Mm-hmm. But if they took about 1 ounce of silver, and they cast a round cylinder type bar, and then they take a tool similar to a machete and they chop a chunk off the end so it's kind of shaped like a silver dollar, and then they put their stamp on there and they hit it with a hammer a few times on one side, put it on the other side and get the other stamp for the back and stamp that, and it kind of squashes out like a mushroom. So it's not a machine round coin like we're used to seeing. Mm-hmm. Those would be called a Cobb coin. And they had pieces of two, pieces of four, pieces of eight. You always hear about the pieces of eight on your pirate movies. The mm-hmm. pirate's chest is full of these pieces of eight Cobb coins. Mm-hmm. Well, the the piece of eight, which is the biggest one, they had gold and silver. But if you had a silver, I've got a number of silver cob coins. And if you had a piece of eight silver, which is about 1 ounce of silver, well, find out what silver's worth today, and it's probably worth $20-$22 an ounce or something. So that coin, weight wise, if we're talking melt price, is worth about $22. If we're talking about antiquity value, that's that, if it's still in good shape, I pay close to $1,000 for one.
Wow.
That's the difference, $22 to $1,000, because of the antiquity value. The problem is the federal government, because of the they're going to use the antiquity law, are going to confiscate those from you if you can't prove where you got it and that you can legally have it, those kind of things. And so a lot of people, lots of people that find antiquities, it doesn't matter whether it's gold or silver or other things, will either keep it quiet or they'll totally destroy it. You find silver coin, a stash of silver coins, and so the government can't say it falls under antiquity law, you melt it down. And now that 1 ounce coin that was worth $1,000 is worth
$20.
Yeah. And that's a travesty.
That's a travesty
because that is history horrible. Is now lost.
You know what bugs me a little bit about this? I'm just, as you're talking, and thank you so much, both of you, for sharing. I think it's important that people hear this. Just a brief example, then I'll jump back to this. Even in Minnesota, up north, probably about 180 miles or from where I'm at right now, if you pick up a rock on the shoreline that has billions of rocks on it, you know, usually people are saying, who's going to miss one rock? Well, it would take thousands of people to literally clean up that entire shore. It is illegal, even in Minnesota, to pick up a rock. Just as has no value. Well, at least in my eyes, it has no value. And again, you keep quiet about it. If you pick up a rock, put it quietly. You're not going to cash it in anywhere, but there are people. I'm an artist up north, and so people do make things out of these rocks to try to sell in the tourist shop that I'm in. But you see very few of these, and people are always wondering, why aren't there more rocks in this tourist shop? Because it's against the law to pick them up to begin with. And secondly, you're certainly not going to sit there and sell them in a tourist shop. So it's kind of, so that leads me back to my question to you guys. Isn't it interesting how if you pick up something like that, it's almost taboo. And people are like, well, keep quiet about it, because if someone knows that it's against the law, they'll probably arrest you, et cetera, et cetera. But you have this meltdown factor. I don't know if you can even bring anything that you guys find, especially in your area, with a meltdown factor, because are they required by law to essentially turn you in if you bring something to somebody and say, yeah, I'd like to kind of sell this to you and or melt it down? What are your thoughts on that? What do you know about that?
All those things you're talking about are questionable. The federal government is greedy, big time greedy. And so lots of things that you find, if the government feels like there isn't a value to it, they couldn't care less. But on the other hand, if they think there's a value to it, then you're in trouble. And I'll give you some examples. Mel Fisher, who's one of the most famous treasure hunters in U.S. history, of course, he's out in the ocean recovering, not in the Uinta Mountains here or whatever. Yeah. But Mel Fisher found the Atoka, which is... he was looking for that specific ship for many years. He found other things, but he finally found that particular ship.
Yep.
They started recovering the gold. And by the way, more than half the gold typically on the Spanish galleons that would sink is contraband. In other words, when you brought gold or silver out of your mines and those kind of things, you had to have the assayer's mark, and you had to have the mine it came from, and you had to have stamped in it that showed that the king of Spain had got his 1/5 tax from that. All these kinds of things. And if you don't have that, it's contraband, it's illegal, and you can suffer severe consequences. They figure that more than half the gold shipped back to Spain was contraband, and that because people didn't want to pay a fifth of their money to the King of Spain and those kind of things. Anyway, so Mel Fisher starts bringing up all this stuff, literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in treasure out in the open ocean where there is no law covering that.
Yeah.
It was such a big treasure that both the state and the federal government extended the legal waters out to encompass it so that they could get most, if not all, of the treasure themselves. And Mel Fisher paid more than half. He paid hundreds of millions of dollars in legal fees over many, many, many years before they finally settled in court that the state and the federal government had no business extending. It wasn't legal for them to extend the waters out so that they could get Mel Fisher's treasure. They lost more than half their treasure in legal fees.
Interesting. Go ahead, Terry. Go ahead.
I'm just going to say back to the antiquities law. You know, Kent's right. Anything older than 50 years old belongs to the government if they want it. I mean, you find a 1972 penny out in the mountains, man. You pick it up, you could go to jail for that. You know, so that's the federal property. You know, the BLM, the Forest Service property. Mm-hmm. If it's on private property, That's a blessing. You know, all you have to do is make an agreement with the private land owner and then it's fair game, you know. So
okay, so go ahead, Ken.
Can I? Okay, so just to expand on that a little bit and show you that you can't go by what the law says, by the word of the law. It's by the feeling of what they think you've got. So as an example of that, and I'm going to go into fossil laws.
Yeah.
Okay, fossil laws, if you read those, and they're very similar to antiquities laws, but you cannot collect legally any fossil of an invertebrate. Anything that has a skeleton in it is illegal for you to search or have in your possession. However, you can go up to Butte, Wyoming, and there are companies up there that lease from the park, the fish fossilized fish park up there, lease from the federal government the property and will furnish you with all the tools for a few bucks. And you can go collect fish fossils all day long, which the federal law says you cannot have in your possession. And yet they're the ones that have the park and they lease it to subcontractors to let you go up and harvest whatever you want. They want to see whatever they can of what you harvest before you take it home. And if you've got anything that's rare, you can't take it. They're going to take that from you. But the law actually says you can't have any of it. But yet the federal government leases to subcontractors to give you money. Several years ago, I think it was in Montana, there was on a private property, because Terry talked about private property, they found at the time the largest dinosaur in the world. They sold it on private property. They sold it to Japan, and our government had a conniption fit over the thing and was going to throw them in prison, arrest their life, do all kinds of stuff. And there was all kinds of things that happened in court in that simply because our government wanted to have that dinosaur, even though it was on private property. So they bend and change and do whatever they want with the law based on if they want what you found.
That's true, and it's subject to personal interpretation of that government official who's over that jurisdiction, that area, and the laws changed. You know, I'm personally bad. I'm in search for a billion-dollar treasure that's up on a private. It's on the Forest Service, but it's on a mining claim. And the way we read the laws is we're entitled to that, but we're getting grief from the Forest Service over it, you know? And so, yeah, it's up to interpretation. I also was tracking down where some giant mummies were and think I know where they're at. But to find out how big a trouble I'd be with the federal government, I got a lawyer out of Arizona and to shield who I was. And I contacted the lawyer in Utah who helped develop the antiquities laws for Utah and put him under client confidentiality, told him basically what I was doing and my plans. My plan's not to loot it, my plan is to get archaeologists in there and share it with the world, you know? I want everybody to know about this. I don't want it to be spirited and hidden away from the rest of us, you know? And so I told him what I was doing and he told me, you just as well sell drugs because you're going to prison just the same, you know, when you get caught. And I thought, I'm not into going to prison, but I would really love to prove that there are ancient giant burial tombs out there with ancient records and things like that, but my hands are tied. What do? You know, unless you're willing to, and I want to be above board with it, unless you're, so that leaves it to the next guy who wants to go in at night and pilferage it and take it, and now the world will never know about it.
Well, that's
one other thing I should probably mention, and that is, since we're supposedly talking about treasure, this is fun, but a lot of the big treasure in the state of Utah and some of the biggest treasures probably in the world are on Indian property in Utah. Right. And that becomes a huge issue because the Indians aren't going to let you go on their property and get this. There's been newspaper articles over the years come out that say, if you know where there's stuff, if you've got an ancient map and it'll take us to a treasure on the Indian property, we'll do a contract with you. And I don't know what they give you, offer you 10%, 15%, and you go on and find it. And that, but then you read the articles where people went through the contract process, and when they were digging up and figured they were right there, then they said, okay, get off Indian ground and don't come back, kind of thing. And that, so every, after two or three people trying to recover on Indian ground through that type of a contractual agreement, everybody just gave up because nobody was getting anything. It was, hey, we think we're getting close, so now get off Indian ground, you know, and they'll
look for it. I can share a story to add to that by someone who I talked with at the conference, who actually lives in that area. And his grandfather, who was about 80, 81 at the time, had permission and was with, I believe, some Indian elder of some sort, who actually brought him to an area, and he showed him where some of these, what they felt were very valuable Indian type treasures or treasure in and of itself. And they didn't want it, what's the word that I'm going to use? They didn't want it, you know, brought up or anything like that. They wanted it left there. And they were standing near the edge of a cliff. And he said, now that I've told you all of this, he said, oh, well. And he pushed this guy's grandfather over the cliff. And of course, from what I understand, those rocks are not smooth, and body parts were strewn all the way down the cliff. And then this gentleman I talked to, he and his family had to go and retrieve the body parts and the grandfather who had been pushed over the cliff. So the thing is that it's interesting because a lot of people, depending on where you live in the United States, do not understand or do not understand the history and or the emotion and or the whatever it is, the ritual or whatever, of some of the places, especially located in Utah, especially, that involved Indian type burial ground or Indian type places where they know where treasure is being hidden or stored, or it's supposed to stay there. Because Kent, yeah, I know we briefly talked about that, but I think that's important for people to know that you just can't go anywhere and just meander around. There's things that happen because of this. Do you think that there's any truth, either of you, to Indian curses?
I don't know about Indian curses, but at one time the Indians were guarding this, and if you got too close, you never left alive, you know. You know, I got to back up. I didn't used to believe in that kind of stuff. So I didn't believe in the paranormal. I didn't believe in ghosts until I met one and talked to one. I talked to a ghost for a half hour, and I didn't know it was a ghost. And I didn't find out for 4 months later that the person I'd talked to had been dead for 10 years. And that flipped my whole world upside down. You know, I don't know what to believe anymore.
Was this out in Utah?
No, this was in Nevada.
Oh, this is
in Arizona, near the Superstition Mountains.
Interesting. Oh, well, we'll get to that in 2 seconds. Hold your thought, because I'm going to lead it right to that place. I just, I just read yesterday, I don't know, talk about timely. Someone had posted somewhere, out of 200 people that you probably have met or in a group or whatever, at least two of them are an apparition of some sort. But let's hold that just for a second.
Pretty good stuff so far. We are going to end part one here with Terry Carter and Kent Smith. As we go into part two to finish this interview, at the end, I am also going to add in a segment on these stories that were provided to me while I was in Utah, Vernal, Utah area, from the Children of the Basin. Thanks for listening tonight.